From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins and VOA executive editor Steve Reddish. Welcome, Chris and Steve.
Thanks for having us.
Well, here are the issues. Deadly fighting continues between Israel and Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip, making this the deadliest Israeli-Palestinian confrontation since the two sides fought a war in 2014. Congressional Democrats called for a ceasefire to the conflict this week, while Republicans condemned the actions of Hamas, saying there was no moral equivalence between the two sides. Despite opposition from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to create an independent bipartisan commission to investigate the U.S. Capitol riot that took place on January 6th. At this point, the legislation will be sent to an uncertain future in the Senate. A bipartisan group of House and Senate negotiators met this week to try to draft a compromise bill overhauling the nation's policing laws. Average COVID-19 case numbers in the U.S. are the lowest they've been in nearly a year, with case tallies down in all 50 states. Mask wearing and social distancing restrictions continue to be eased across the U.S. and abroad as more people are vaccinated. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Steve, I'll start with you. We now have world leaders, in addition to President Biden, calling for a ceasefire in Israel, but it does not seem to be working. Is this an international problem that should be solved by the U.S. and other countries?
It is an international problem that the United States and other countries have been trying to solve for decades. In his phone call with Prime Minister Netanyahu on Wednesday, and that was the fourth phone call that the president has had with Prime Minister Netanyahu in the past week. President Biden is said to have strongly conveyed that he expected a quick de-escalation of the situation on a way to a ceasefire. That was the first time in those four phone calls that anything was really described as anything less than full support for Israel's right to defend itself. The United States has been trying quietly to de-escalate the situation. You can look at the phone call on Tuesday as a much bigger push of Prime Minister Netanyahu to find a way to end the situation and get to a ceasefire. Publicly, Biden has been supportive of Israel's right to defend itself, but he's getting political pressure from progressives in the Democratic Party. When Biden visited Dearborn, Michigan on Tuesday to tout making more electric cars, it's also home to one of the biggest Arab American communities, and several thousand protested during Biden's visit about the U.S. position on Israel. And Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, the first and only Palestinian descended member of Congress, met Biden as he arrived at the airport and is said to have confronted the president about the policy of supporting Israel. So Biden is getting pressure from his progressive wing in the Democratic Party, and he's getting pushback from Republicans who are full-throated in their support of Israel and do not equate the disparity of casualties. They are saying that Israel has a right to defend itself, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is continuing so far to conduct the operation against Hamas.
Chris, the fighting between Israel and Hamas was triggered by days of escalating clashes between Palestinians and Israeli police at a holy site that is revered by both Muslims and Jews. What can you tell us about these clashes and the root causes of why they initially occurred?
Well, there's a number of factors. You have a lot of violence now between Israelis and Israeli Arabs in the area. And you have a conflict where Jewish settlers accused the Palestinians of taking what was once their land and living in their area. And the dispute now is over. Some Palestinians have not wanted to pay rent, and the Israelis have tried to get them out of there. And so that has kind of inflamed tensions, and we see more intercommunal violence going on in East Jerusalem, which really kind of touch this latest conflict off.
Also, according to a recent Gallup poll, 75% of Americans still hold favorable views of Israel, but a growing number are sympathetic towards the Palestinians. For example, there is a huge surge of social media messages with calls to action. So I'll just throw this out to both of you. Are these social media messages shifting attitudes here in the U.S. and even globally, such as last summer's global activism against racial injustice?
More than social media has been just a lack of end game and a continuation of the violence. This is the fourth or fifth time since the Israelis pulled out of Gaza that there's been clashes that have gone on for days and days, and other times weeks and longer. This has been going on for years. And I think that instead of not necessarily social media, although that certainly augments the message, Americans are looking for a solution. And right now, while it's happening now, it is not one of the top priorities of the Biden administration, which is trying to get the United States back on an economic track, you know, post-pandemic.
I think too that there needs to be a coalition, and whether social media plays a role in that, but getting parties together to try to talk about resolving this conflict. And I think the only countries now that have influence with Hamas are Turkey, the Qataris and Qatar, the Egyptians, and Iran. But it's been hard to reach out to some of the Hamas leaders because they've been on the run and don't want to communicate electronically, fearing that Israel will target them. But there needs to be a concerted effort, and whether it's galvanized in private or on social media, to get these parties talking to try to create some environment where we could have a ceasefire. And the demands on both sides are pretty stiff, and it may be hard to get them to agree to a ceasefire in which Israel wants Hamas to stop building tunnels towards Israel. Israel wants Hamas to stop firing indiscriminately at Israeli civilian locations. It's just been a tough battle since, you know, Israel pulled out of Gaza in 2005, and that ended 38 years of Israeli occupation. And now you've got a situation where you have Palestinians caught in the middle. About 2 million in Gaza are caught in the middle of this conflict and losing lives every day.
That is true. There's a great humanitarian crisis that is developing as this violence continues. But let's move on now to the U.S. House of Representatives voted to create a commission to independently investigate the rioting that occurred on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. So with this, Steve, what's going to happen now with this legislation as it goes to the Senate?
Well, both Republican leaders, the Republican leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, and the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, have signaled their displeasure with the idea of an independent commission. 35 Republicans in the House of Representatives defied Kevin McCarthy and voted for the commission. But in the Senate, it doesn't depend on a 50-50 vote. Democrats who want to pass this will need 60 votes, 3/5 of the Senate, and they need 10 Republicans, since the Senate is evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. They need 10 Republicans to agree to vote for this independent commission to get it started. Finding 10 Republicans to cross over and vote with Democrats is going to be difficult. One of them, Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, will likely, since he is retiring, doesn't have to face voters again, may vote for the commission, but finding 9 others is going to be difficult, especially in a political year. One of the possibilities, Senator Susan Collins is one of the more moderate senators. has said that she will not vote for a commission unless it wraps up its work by the end of this year, that it won't bleed into the election year of 2022, where all of the House of Representatives and a third of the Senate are up for election.
And Chris, so why are politicians saying that an independent view is necessary? For example, Utah Senator Mitt Romney said, and I'll quote him, "We should understand what mistakes were made and how we can prevent them from happening again," unquote. So is this necessary?
I think in a lot of people's eyes it is, because it was a history-making event. At no time since British rule of this country have we seen a storming of the United States Capitol, the hallmark of our democracy, in an attempt to prevent the certification of a democratically held election. And people died, and police officers were attacked, and a tremendous amount of people were terrified, and their lives were put at risk, both lawmakers, staff, and everyone else who was up at the Capitol on January 6th. So not only do we want to know what went wrong as far as the intelligence, why didn't police and the Capitol Police beef up their security? Were they aware that this was a planned attack on the United States Capitol? You know, who was involved with it? We still have not gotten a lot of answers to those questions. And then putting together a kind of after action report that would spell out all the steps that have to be taken to prevent something like this from never happening again. And I think on the Republican side, they think this kind of commission is not necessary. It'll get in the way of their messaging as they attempt to take back the House of Representatives in 2022. Other Democrats say we have to have this commission in order to make sure it doesn't happen again. And then there's pushback from some Republicans who think that in addition to looking at what happened on January 6th and the insurrectionists, there should also be investigations into Antifa and Black Lives Matter and what caused some of the social justice and racial justice demonstrations, in some cases rioting, over the summer of last year.
Yes, that is so correct. I'm glad you brought that up, because that was going to be my next question to you. So House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, he said in a statement regarding this bill that, quote, "given the political misdirections and given the speaker's short-sighted scope that does not examine interrelated forms of political violence in America, I cannot support this legislation." And so that kind of goes back to what you were saying there, Chris. But Steve, do you think this is a good argument for not supporting the bill?
There are investigations underway for both the January 6th riot in Congress, as well as what was going on as social unrest during the summer. I think that you can make those arguments, but you also have to look at what Republicans did at the time. And when they were in power in 2018, they did not go into investigations into some of the political statements and political violence that happened while they were on watch. So that kind of argument is certainly very political and rather specious. It did not convince 35 members of his own conference to vote against the commission. And I think that now in the Senate, there's going to be probably some sort of compromise made to get several more Republicans to vote along with Senator Romney, who you quoted quite eloquently as far as the need for such a commission. So I think that we'll see in the next few weeks some moves toward it. And it's going to be a difficult ride for Democrats, because this is just such a highly charged time that we are in.
Absolutely. So we'll see how this develops in the Senate. Time now for a short break, and when we come back, we will talk about another bipartisan bill at the top of the legislative agenda. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two, then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Senior TV Correspondent Chris Simpkins and VOA Executive Editor Steve Reddish. Well, another bipartisan group of House and Senate negotiators met to try to draft a compromise bill overhauling the nation's policing laws. So far, Steve, where does this bill stand in terms of getting it passed?
It is in the process of moving forward, which in Senate terms is stuck in the mud. The two senators who are working on trying to forge a compromise and get this bill through are meeting up with resistance within their own parties. And the big issue is qualified immunity. Republican Senator Tim Scott, who is the only Black Republican in the Senate, has been working on trying to modify and try to find the right compromise regarding qualified immunity. Democrats want to get rid of qualified immunity or water it down so that qualified immunity, which protects police officers from being sued for misconduct while they're on duty and conducting their policing duties, Democrats want to change that. Republicans want to keep that. And that's where the rub is. Possibly we might see something later in the summer or in the early fall coming out of the Senate as far as this is concerned.
Yes, and looking at what's included in this bill, Chris, the bill aims to end certain police techniques, including chokeholds and carotid holds, two forms of potentially deadly force. The bill also seeks to improve police training and invest in community programs designed to improve policing and promote equitable new policies, as Steve was pointing out. So is this bill really meant to satisfy activists? How is it really going to work out on the street?
I think it could satisfy a lot of activists who say right now we have nothing and that legislation really is needed to create change. And I think the other thing that this bill does that's important is to create a national registry of data of complaints of police misconduct and records these complaints and compiled in reports. Right now, we have no idea of the number of officer misconduct or out of bounds police practices such as stops and searches. And we have to be aware of these things that are happening by watching body cam footage of police officers, again, pulling over suspects, beating them, kicking them, dragging them, and dying in their custody. And I'm speaking of a video that was just released by the Associated Press of the death of a 49-year-old unarmed Black man who was in police custody back in 2019 in an encounter with the Louisiana State Police. And the state police said that his death was due to other causes, and it appears there's an alleged cover-up going on in the opinions of a lot of people because the police department did not want to release the footage and even did not apparently provide an accurate account in a police report of what actually happened. So this legislation would prevent these kinds of things from happening and make sure that we know which police departments have problems in them and which don't. I mean, a lot, as I've told you before, Kim, the vast majority of police officers are doing their jobs in professional manners, but there is apparently problems throughout law enforcement of racism and misconduct and police brutality that's got to be solved.
Yes, this most recent case with the release of the body cam footage of Andrew Brown Jr., which has also led to protests in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. And in looking at these protests, do you all see this as a continuation of the protests that have occurred over the year as a result of cases like this? Or is this case different from other cases, Steve?
I think this is a continuation and as well as a sign of frustration that even after George Floyd, even after the conviction of the police officer, while some of it is coming to light now, still happening in many parts of the country.
And also to your point, Chris, one law professor with an expertise on state and federal criminal procedure, Stephanie Hartung, she pointed out that in this case with Andrew Brown Jr., he was not charged with a violent crime. And the video unveiled this week indicates Brown was not trying to use his car to injure the deputies, but rather to flee them. So again, going back to the video is not showing what the police officers are reporting.
Well, the prosecutor, from the officer's point of view, they continue to maintain that Mr. Brown was using his vehicle as a weapon. The video appears to show Mr. Brown backing away from the officers and trying to drive around them. He nearly comes in contact with one of the officers, but he begins to drive away from the officers when the officers open fire. And the bullets striking Mr. Brown and one of them in the head that actually killed him. So there are vast interpretations of the amount of force that officers can reasonably use when they feel that they are in danger and protecting themselves. But as the video looks, in my opinion, Mr. Brown was driving away and they did fire. But prosecutors say it doesn't matter. He put police in harm's way, and they had every reasonable right to take that kind of action against him.
And I'll just go ahead and end this topic on, this is a quote from North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. He called on federal officials to investigate, adding in a statement, quote, public confidence would have been better served with a special prosecutor and by quickly making public the incident footage, unquote, which goes back to some of the points that Steve and Chris, you both had made. Well, some good news to report on the fight against coronavirus. Here in the U.S., cases are down in all states, and the COVID-19 vaccine is available in the U.S. for everyone 12 years of age or older. Well, with this has come an ease on restrictions with more places opening, but some CDC guidelines are creating confusion as cities and businesses struggle with mask rules. Steve, I know I'm hearing people say the rule that if you have not been vaccinated, you still have to wear a mask is confusing, and even some are saying a form of discrimination. Your thoughts on this?
I think, as you said, the masking guidelines from the CDC took everybody by surprise, especially after all the time and effort that was spent in the past year to get people to wear masks, both indoors and outdoors. It's created a lot of confusion. I really feel sorry for the business owners who want to protect their workforce by having customers wear masks, but they don't have the force of either law or social norms to enforce the mask requirements. And I think it's going to wind up being on the private sector to come up with guidelines and figure out who's been vaccinated and who hasn't been vaccinated.
Chris, your thoughts on the feedback you've gotten?
Well, I've been going around Washington and in nearby Virginia, and I just want to say it's nice to see that, especially in downtown Washington, D.C., which had been shut down, more people are returning to offices and to restaurants. And I think it's going to take a more determined effort from businesses to really outline what their policies are. Just an example, my small grocery store here, they sent out an email saying that all of their employees have been vaccinated for the last 2 months, and they would request that people who are not vaccinated wear masks. But people who have been fully vaccinated, feel free to come into the small store without the mask. And they admit that this is the honor system, but they're hoping that their customers will be honest. And I think that's what the onus is now on the American people. How honest will people be who aren't vaccinated and show up in a place without a mask on? And I think there's pressure also on the administration to open things up and get the economy jump-started again. I think it was a balance between health policy, politics, and the economy that kind of drove this. It may create some confusion, but a lot of people hope as we go on here over the next several months, more people are vaccinated. Each individual businesses will begin to work out their own policies. Big question is, how do you enforce it? Again, it's kind of going to be totally up to the honesty of each individual.
Okay, well, it looks like we're going to have to end the show on that note. Thanks to our panelists, VOA Senior TV Correspondent Chris Simpkins and VOA Executive Editor Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis. Thanks for joining us for Issues in the News on The Voice of America.